going to be sending out to these astronomers that are going to be getting a complimentary copy of A Matter of Days. And my dear wife has edited it, so it's ready for announcement. I'm going to read the letter to you, just so you know what these astronomers will get by way of a cover letter. Well, editing never ends. Okay, it says, "Dear fellow astronomer, as you may be aware, astronomers and astronomy education have come under attack in recent years. A certain segment of the Christian community, as well as some Jewish and Islamic groups, have made belief in a young Earth pivotal to their faith. These young Earth creationists recently persuaded school boards in Kansas, Ohio, and Georgia to pass motions making teaching about any objects beyond our solar system optional. They did the same to teaching about radiometric dating. Had these motions been upheld, they would have essentially eliminated astronomy education from public schools. Propaganda from these groups has stirred distrust of astronomy research. Any paper that even hints at revisions to one or more sets of Big Bang models is touted and celebrated as an overthrow of astronomical knowledge. Astronomers are frequently characterized as deceivers, protecting their favorite origins myth. My experience in interacting with both university and church audiences convinces me that astronomers cannot afford to remain silent, assuming this nonsense will simply evaporate with time. We must be prepared to speak up, and that is especially true for those among us who respect and embrace the historic Christian faith. To that end, please accept this complimentary copy of my latest book, A Matter of Days. I hope you'll find it worthy of consideration and use. Written from a Christian perspective, the book demonstrates that young Earth creationist ideology springs from gross errors and misunderstandings of both the Bible and the astronomical data. It seeks to do so in a gentle, respectful way so as to promote objectivity and avoid fueling passions. I encourage you to use material from this book whenever students, parents, or school boards raise challenges to well-established astronomy. Many of these people experience great consternation. Perhaps this book will help them find peace and resolution. Also, please be alert to opportunities to address astronomy phobia in schools, churches, and elsewhere. Our discipline will benefit greatly from increased trust, support, and appealing to outstanding students. Sincerely yours." So that's the letter that we're going to be sending out. And kind of the principle behind this is, if we look at what the Bible says about controversies in the past, Acts chapter 15 addresses an issue where if you want to be a Christian, you got to be circumcised. And so that wasn't going down very well with the Gentiles. And likewise today, there's this theme that, hey, if you want to be a Christian, then you better dump your astronomy education and background, not listen to those astronomers. What the cure was in the first century? I mean, let's admit it. The church had this council. They put out this letter. But Paul and his disciples were being persecuted well after the letter was distributed. That issue really did not disappear until Gentiles got involved in the church. Once Gentiles became the majority, that was the end of the circumcision issue. And likewise, I'm seeing a problem here that astronomers are being kept out of the church. In fact, I have one friend who was literally asked to leave four consecutive churches where he became a member. He was told to hit the road. And here's my friend Gary Fouts, who's a professor in astronomy at Santa Monica. I forget the college. Santa Monica City College is where he teaches astronomy. But yeah, and he didn't make an issue out of this. But what happened was, he'd be a member of a church, and sooner or later they would ask him what he did for a living. Said, "I teach astronomy." And I said, "Oh." And then they said, "Well, you know, we're going to have to ask you to leave this church." And that happened to him four consecutive times. And he said, "You know, I was not making a big deal about the age of the universe. I made a commitment to keep quiet about it, but I made a commitment I wouldn't keep quiet about my profession. So I don't think I have to be ashamed about being an astronomer." So, but that's one reason why we think it's important that astronomers really take this seriously and get involved. And hopefully they'll realize that not all Christians, not all churches are against astronomy. That's kind of my main motive in getting this out, is that so many of my friends in astronomy have given up on the church in total. And, hey, there are those of us in the church who don't think astronomy is inherently evil, and they need to know that there are Christians who aren't against them. So, yeah. Well... Okay, well, right now we've raised $2,900, and we're saying, you know, where can this have the greatest impact? And we thought, let's go after the astronomers who are teaching at the college and university level, and let's make sure we cover at least the state of California. It'd be nice if we could cover a good chunk of the rest of the country. So, but, you know, we'll let this run a little longer, and then we'll send them out. And who knows, if we get a really good response, that might enable us to send it out a little more broadly. But I think we have to, I think we've got enough money now, we can at least get it out to teaching astronomers in California. So, and then after that, if we have enough money, we'd like to get it out to the non-teaching astronomers. Most astronomers don't teach astronomy. The teaching astronomers are the minority. But and there, I think we would go after the most influential astronomers first, like the chairmen of the department. Those are the people we want to target first. So, in terms of how we use the money, we're going to try to target the most influential astronomers and the teaching astronomers first. If we got more money after that, then we'll try to hit the rest. And yeah, there's a lot of people teaching at the high school level that need this too. But we think the college and university level has got to be our top priority. Yeah. We have to be a little bit careful on how broadly we advertise this fundraising effort. And the reason is, if the younger creationists catch wind that we're doing this, then this could lead to... Yeah, I mean, I can anticipate what their counterattacks are going to be, and I want to make sure that we actually get this thing off the ground and actually get these books mailed out before that counterattack hits. And so we give this too much publicity, we're going to have a problem. I think so. Well, I'm going to get behind it. Okay, any more questions before we move on? All right. In terms of a scientific discovery to talk to you about today, a lot's happened in the astronomical literature. I mean, these are just the front pages of the past 2 weeks. I mean, probably 30 papers here. Really exciting stuff. But I'm thinking not from my perspective. I mean, what's most exciting for me? Well, probably the dipole anisotropy of the first all-sky X-ray cluster sample is most exciting to me. And I thought, well, how am I going to get this across to the class? Okay. I could do it, but I decided I'd pick something that I think I can accomplish in less time than trying to explain to you why X-ray cluster samples are so exciting. Okay. And this actually, and I picked this on purpose because it shows you how sometimes negative science can have a positive influence. And so this is a discovery that shows that someone's previous scientific claim must be wrong. And what we're talking about is a famous paper, one of the most famous papers published on this subject, was published back in 1997. And there were some Danish scientists who went to Greenland, and they were looking at carbon samples in ancient rocks. And they published a stunning paper where they said, we have evidence in these rocks off of Akilia Island in Greenland that life was present on planet Earth 3.85 billion years ago, 3.85, 3.86 billion years ago. And you know, that paper held up for some time, and the first time it was called into question was when a group of astronomers did a careful study on the moon and found out that the late heavy bombardment, which was previously dated at 3.9 to 3.92 billion years ago, actually came in at 3.85 billion years ago. And so this was a problem. I mean, if you've got the planet Molten 600 kilometers deep, how can you have life on this Kilia rock sample off of Greenland? And then some people went back to Greenland, and they were not, they tried to get some sample rocks there, and they said, we don't think the dating was done as accurate as it needs to be on the sample. And then there was a study done in 2002 which showed that the carbon could not be proven to be of biological origin in this particular sample. And finally, today was announced, or last week was announced, where a group went to Greenland, took the same rock area, and repeated the whole experiment. Looked at 15 samples all over these rocks on Achillea Island, and they could not duplicate the results done in 1997. Now, what I think is really good about this, this announcement closes with a statement that the original Danish research team is going to join forces with the team that has shown that they could not duplicate their results. They're going to go back to Achillea Island. They said, you know what? We need to do a much more thorough study there because we think we can come up with an accurate date for the first light. These are the oldest rocks in the world. There's no other place in the world where we have rocks as old as we have on this Achillea Island. And I said, let's combine forces and see what we can come up with. But the bottom line is the scientific community has now reached a consensus that there was not life on planet Earth that early. The earliest life that we have found is 3.80 billion years ago, not 3.85. And of course, that I was telling you about the late heavy bombardment a few weeks ago, where we can establish that bombardment was intense enough to turn the whole surface of planet Earth into liquid magma 400, 500, 600 kilometers deep, some places even 800 kilometers deep, at a temperature of 3,000 degrees. Obviously, you're not going to have life surviving under those conditions. And if you were catching our creation update webcast, last week we talked about a discovery. Actually, we didn't. We had to do it this week. We didn't get to it. Sometimes that happens. But we had a plan for last week. Which is they've now determined how long it would take the late heavy bombardment to subside where you would have liquid water and a solid crust. And that's because they've identified the cause of the late heavy bombardment. You know, last couple of weeks ago I talked about how we look at the moon and we can show that the bombardment was intense enough to liquefy the Earth's surface about 600 kilometers deep. A new study has identified the cause, namely that the early solar system is still what they call planetesimals. And planetesimals just basically means small bodies. And these small bodies collide with one another and coalesce and make planets. That's how planet Earth came about. A bunch of planetesimals joined together and made a planet. Well, the exhaustion of those planetesimals takes place first in terms of the planetesimals that are in the plane of the solar system. The last planetesimals to remain in the solar system are those at high inclination orbits. So if you can think of the plane of the solar system as being like this, these would be planetesimals with orbits like this, where they'd be orbiting like this, where the rest of the solar system is orbiting like that. And so the late heavy bombardment would be the final exhaustion of the planetesimals, but that final exhaustion are planetesimals with very high inclinations. Consequently, when they collide with the Earth, they collide at very high velocities. And the energy you get from a collision, well, you remember your junior high physics class, the energy is 1/2 times the mass times the velocity squared. And so what the planetesimals aren't more massive. That's what they were looking at the moon. They said the moon must have been hit with bigger bodies to cause all that damage. This new study shows, no, they weren't bigger, they were just faster. And, you know, if you increase the velocity by a factor of 4 times, that means it hits with 16 times the energy. And so that explains why you get such huge damage from such small bodies, because they have these orbits. But because we've now identified that that's the cause of the late heavy bombardment, we can also calculate how long it would take to subside. And the answer is, for a complete subsidence, it's 60 million years. So if it peaks at 3.85 billion years ago, It's going to take a good 50 million years for it to subside enough where you're going to have solid rocks and liquid water over a good part of the Earth and where the origin of life would even be possible. Bottom line is, it really does establish that the origin of life took place in a geological instant. Because if you got this late heavy bombardment, 3.85 billion years, and it takes 50 or 60 million years for this thing to subside, and you got the origin of life well established at 3.84 billion years ago, that means it took place in a geological instant. But it also is comforting to recognize that this discovery of life as ancient at 3.85 billion years has now been established by a variety of lines of research to be false. So, sometimes showing something is wrong enables a particular model or explanation of life to become much more secure than it's become in the past. This basically eliminates the confusion about the time of the origin of life on planet Earth. So, 3.80, we're in good shape. All right, if there are no questions, let's move on to the Book of Job. By the way, I had a fun time with the Covenant class this past hour, and I think I was able to put a real good seed there in the class to the effect that you have to get past Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 if you want to understand the Bible's message on creation. The questions that they were raising are questions that are answered in the very text that we're looking at. And so hopefully I've stimulated them to really begin to study these other creation accounts. Now, in terms of Job 38, you know, this is that one part of our section in Job. We're basically studying the different creation accounts in the Bible, and this one runs from Job 34 to Job 41. And here in Job 38, it's the beginning of God's address. So God has kept silent in terms of his debate amongst these five men until the 38th chapter. You know, Elihu speaks, and then the Lord speaks. And the first thing the Lord does, he's got lots of things on his agenda here, but the first thing he does is he basically reviews Genesis 1. So the entire chapter, Job 38, is God interrupting this debate and starting his discourse with a review of Genesis chapter 1. And what we've been doing is going through this chapter and trying to pick out the six creation days and what it's got to tell us about the six creation days. So this is an excellent passage to take people to settle their concerns, their disputes, and fights over what is the interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. And of course, it's not the only one. You've got Psalm 104 and Proverbs 8 that do the same thing. And so these are three poetic passages that should help us to really understand more accurately the interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. But as I've mentioned in the past, it's poetry, and a poetry isn't the same as prose, where you've got Genesis chapter 1 neatly laid out, creation day 1, followed by creation day 2, followed by creation day 3. When you read Job 38, it doesn't make any mention at all of the creation days. But what you see as you go through the poetry is it's clearly addressing the content of what takes place on the six creation days, but it bounces around. And again, that's just the way Hebrew poetry is structured. We look at it from an English perspective, and we expect and demand a perfect chronology. That's not what's happening here. And just a review where we covered the last few weeks. Creation Day 1 is discussed in Job 38, verses 4 through 9, 12 through 14, and 19 to 21. So there's an excellent example of how Creation Day 1 is dealt with in Job, and literally in the first part, the middle part, and the end part, it talks about creation day one. Now, what makes this somewhat challenging for the English reader, we look at creation day two, that's also covered in verses 4 through 9. So verses 4 through 9 are commenting both on Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and therefore we need to look at it in the context of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and see which of these five verses is dealing with which day. But if you do that, it's not that difficult to make your way through. But then Job 38, 22 to 30, and 34 to 38 also address Creation Day 2. And we didn't quite finish Creation Day 3, but I'm not going to bother to do it. I'm going to leave that as an exercise for the student, because we've been on it for two consecutive weeks, and each time we have failed to finish it. I'm afraid that if I do that again, the same thing's going to happen. We'll get a real good start on it, but we won't finish it. And basically what we did do is we looked at creation day 3 as it is addressed in verses 8 through 11, verses 16 through 18, but we never got to 25 to 30. I'm going to leave that as an exercise for the students, but those are the three texts that deal with creation day 3. Now, what is interesting about Job 38, it focuses much more attention on creation days 1, 2, and 3 than it does 4, 5, and 6. So you're going to be amazed at how quickly it gets through creation days 4, 5, and 6. And instead of dealing with three passages each, I mean, this is interesting. Creation days 1, 2, and 3, you find them in three separate sections of Job 38. Creation day 4, there's only two sections. Creation day 5, there's only two sections. And creation day 6, only one portion of Job 38 that deals with it. Now, what I find interesting about this treatment is what are the places that Christians really fight and dispute the interpretation of Genesis 1? A lot more of it is focused on the first three creation days than the last three creation days. So maybe that explains the content, but also I think it's explained by the fact when you get to Psalm 104, there it's really heavy on creation days 4, 5, and 6. So if you're complaining that it doesn't say too much about 4, 5, and 6, well, just wait. Eventually we'll get to Psalm 104, and then we're going to see a lot more content in 4, 5, and 6. That's also true of Proverbs chapter 8. It puts more content on those days. So, but in terms of creation day 4, the first place we run into it is verses 12 through 15, and we'll see it again in verses 31 to 33. So in verse 12, have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? The earth takes shape like clay under a seal. Its features stand out like those of a garment. The wicked are denied their light, and their upraised arm is broken. That's verse 15. We flip over to 31 to 33. Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons? Or lead out the bear with its cubs? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Now, in the context of creation day 1, one of the big controversies that we see is exactly what happens in the context of let there be light. Now, if you go out and pick up most of the commentaries on Genesis chapter 1, most of them will try to claim that's when God created the light. But we spent some time looking at verses 4 through 9 and saying, no, that's not what's going on. Because verses 4 through 9, verse 8 in particular, makes the point that when God created the earth and it was in its primordial state, formless and void, part of that formless and voidness is that the earth was enshrouded with these clouds that kept the surface in darkness, meaning there was light outside, but there was no light on the surface of the earth. And this is a huge step in trying to understand only the context of creation day 1, but creation day 4. Because the big issue in creation day 4, people look at creation day 4 in Genesis chapter 1, and it talks about the great lights. Let there be the great lights. But again, if you pick up most commentaries in Genesis chapter 1, what you'll see in them is this idea that's when God created the sun, moon, and stars. Job 38 would tell us, maybe not so fast. Because what was happening in creation day 1 was not that God created the light, but rather he performed miracles in the clouds so that they were no longer a thick blanket enshrouding the earth in darkness, verse 8. Rather, the clouds were now allowing the light from outside in the heavens to pass through to the surface of the earth. This should at least give you pause when you come to creation day 4 and say, is this really the creation of the sun, moon, and stars for the first time? Or is this simply when the sun, moon, and stars become visible for the first time? Now, in our time in Genesis chapter 1, we made note of the fact that verse 14 in Genesis 1 makes the comment, let there be the great light. The same verb that you see in creation day 1, let there be light. It doesn't say that God created the light or he made the light. He says, let the light be. Likewise, 1:14 doesn't say that God created the sun, moon, and stars. It says, let the great lights be. And so could this be a reference to the fact that the great lights have always been there, but this is the first time they be or appear at the surface of the waters? And what you see in verse 15 and following was the statement, so that they may serve as signs to mark days and seasons and years. Well, who needs the marking of these signs? It's the creatures that God makes on creation days 5 and 6. These are the first creatures that are complex enough that they need at least the occasional visibility of the sun, moon, and stars so that they can regulate their biological clocks. The bacteria don't need that. Insects don't need that. At least certain insects don't need that. But birds and mammals do need the visibility. Even the mollusks need the visibility. It's interesting to think that just a little lowly oyster needs to have some visibility of the sun, moon, and stars so that they can regulate their biological clocks. So those are the creatures of creation day 5 and 6, so that they may serve. Okay, what do we see here in Job 38? Well, giving orders to the morning, or showing the dawn its place, talks about the earth taking shape like clay under a seal. And the way a seal was worked, you'd have this little bit of wax and you push it in there. So it's making the point that you're able to see that the earth is like this, and that would show up for the first time when you actually see the stars. You're probably going to notice that when you go to Mount Wilson. If you stay there long enough, you're going to notice that the star patterns kind of move like you'd expect the earth under a seal. You'll see this rotation effect. You look up at the skies, you notice the stars turn kind of like a pinwheel. In fact, if you have a little camera and just take an all-night shot, you'll see that the stars transcribe these circles about the North Star. That would have been really obvious to the ancients. It's always amazing to me, as well-educated as we are in the 21st century, when I take people on a star party, they look up and say, oh, stars are moving. So is this the first time in your life you've ever noticed that the stars move? And the moon isn't in the same position. It moves over the... the ancients... They were better educated in these things than we are. They just knew that that's the way it works. And so this kind of imagery we see here in Job would immediately catch to them. And, we read this, earth takes shape like clay under a seal. What's that all about? You say, well, I better skip that passage and move on. Yeah, Kathy? Well, that could work. I mean, you could say this is simply an extension of the discussion on creation day 3, which is immediately previous to that, where it talks about God setting limits for the oceans, puts doors and bars in place. This far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt. So, yeah, in the sense that God does set the earth in that fashion. Well, that's one of the benefits of poetry, is you can do lots of things at once. And you know, when we get into chapter 39, we're going to see that the focus is on the soulless creatures. So if you look at the whole context of what God is doing in Job 38 through to 42, you know, he's speaking to these five men, and he's saying, you know, what's the main theme of all these chapters of God's discourse? He's basically talking to these five men and the entire human race and saying, you think you're so smart and you got it all figured out. You really don't. And you really don't know even the half of what, or a tenth, or the thousandth of what I've done. And you know, here the Lord has been listening for 37 chapters to all his debate, while these five guys are patting themselves in the back about how much they've been able to figure out about the creation, about God. And the Lord basically sits them down and says, look, I got a little creation test I want to give you. Here's a quiz, a pop quiz. Let's see how well you do on this pop quiz. And then what he brings out here is that, you know, there's a lot more going on in creation than you've even dreamed about or discussed. And let me just give you a little bit of what's going on here. But at the same time, he's giving us, you know, a future generation, some reflection on what he's done in Genesis chapter 1. He's also talking to us and saying, are you any better than these five men that lived 4,000 years ago or 3,500 years ago? And, you know, we look at this and say, could we pass this creation test? I don't think so. So with all these centuries of knowledge that have gone by, you know, with Stephen Hawking making the point that we're on the verge of discovering the theory of everything, well, I think if Stephen Hawking were to read these four chapters, he would realize we're not really that close to discovering the theory of everything. So, but maybe we're suffering from the same disease as Job's three friends, where we think, hey, you know, we got it all figured out. So a lot, there's a lot going on here in the text. And what I'm going to try to do as we move through Job 39, 40, 41, and 42 is to try to bring out, you know, the additional message we see here in Job 38. But for now, I'm focusing on the 6 days. I think that's in here. There's a lot more going on in here. The Lord is answering Job out of the storm. What's the storm imagery all about? And we'll pick that up in a little bit. That's kind of interesting because Job 37 was talking about the weather, and the Lord fixes time to begin this discourse. Moving on, creation day 4. When we get into verses 31 and 33, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? And again, if you go back to the context of Genesis chapter 1, it's making the point here, just like Genesis chapter 1 goes, that these stars, these constellations, serve a purpose. They serve a purpose for the higher animals. And, you know, these constellations in their seasons, you can look up at the stars and tell what season you're in, what time of year, when we should plant the crops. And basically, if you read ancient history, that's what they did. They looked at the stars to figure out when they should plant, when they should put the seeds in the ground. And so the stars did serve that purpose. But I think from our perspective, what's really interesting here, this is something that really hit me when I was reading the Bible seriously for the first time at age 17. Looked at this passage, and I'd been studying astronomy since I was 7. I says, isn't it really interesting? Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? So seeing the Pleiades stars, they're bound somehow by God, but that God has loosed the cords of Orion. And I remember at age 17 looking at this and saying, this is just exactly what I'm seeing in my astronomy textbooks. We've now made careful measurements of the Pleiades star cluster and realized that they are gravitationally bound, and it's literally going to take billions of years before that binding will end. But we make measurements of the Orion star cluster, and we realize that they're already being loosed from their bounds. And we look at Orion as an unbound cluster and the Pleiades as a bound cluster. And here we got this text written 3,400, 3,500, 3,600 years ago, telling us stuff that astronomers have only discovered in the late 20th century. So that impressed me, that the Bible was able to be so accurate and predicting future astronomical discoveries. And it also impressed me that the ancients were so familiar with the Pleiades and Orion, and indeed it shows up in lots of extra-biblical writings. And, you know, that was a marker. When you begin to see the Pleiades rise in the sky, that means that winter is coming and you better take care of your fields. And likewise, Orion, the brightest constellation in the sky, was a sign that you're in the midst of winter, and when it begins to disappear, that's the time when you can start planting your crops. So you can see Orion up until about the middle of spring or the beginning of spring. Here's the time to plant. And of course, most of you probably know what the bear and the cubs are all about, right? That's the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. The Big Dipper is the big bear, and the Little Dipper is the cub of the big bear. And so that, again, is something that helps us to find our way in the sky. I did this with my boys when they were really young. I kind of get out these stars that glow in the dark, and I put them on their ceiling and put the Big Dipper out there, the Little Dipper out there. So I say, you know what? Every night you're going to know how to find where north is just by looking up at your ceiling. So if you're ever lost in the woods, you're out somewhere, you can look up the sky, and you know which direction is north. You don't need a compass as long as you can see the stars. That works well in California. Didn't work well where I grew up. Could hardly ever see those stars. But even the ancients were aware that this indeed was a way that they could find their direction. You know, they didn't have GPS in those days, but they did have the bear and the cub to help them find their way around. And it's not just we human beings that use this. The point in Genesis chapter 1, this is something that all the higher animals make use of. But then it makes the point. Do you understand all this? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? I mean, can you men, with all of your wisdom and learning, actually design another planet where everything would work well so that life could be supported? 21st century, we're nowhere close to having that kind of understanding of the physics of the earth or the solar system, that even if we had the resources, we could design something so that it could all work. And I especially like verse 33, do you know the laws of the heavens, in the context of Stephen Hawking's boast and the boast of a lot of string theorists that were on the verge of coming up with the great physics theory of everything. And by the way, when Stephen Hawking talks about discovering the theory of everything, he means exactly that. He means that he's on the verge of coming up with a set of equations that will actually be able to predict the future, and been able to explain the free will of humanity, and even give us the mind of God, that we would know everything that God knows. And if one thing that we see in the book of Job is, God is making a point to these five men, you don't know as much as I know. You don't understand as much as I understand, and you're never going to come close. And so evidently we have people like Job's three friends, and holding down chairs of the physics in major universities around the world today. Yes. Well, yeah, I have. This is something I studied when I was a kid, looking at all these stories about the constellations and where they came from. And yeah, the ancient civilization really tried to build their religious story on the stars. But what you discover when you read into that is that they came up with a story first. So they said, this is the religious story we want to tell. Now let's see if we can back this up with the constellations. So he looked up at the sky and said, you know, we're going to figure out these different constellations to back up our story. So it wasn't that the constellations gave them the story. That's a common myth today. In fact, it's a myth that's running through the Christian community. There's been books out called The Gospel and the Stars. That's probably the most famous of the books, but there is at least half a dozen of books of that theme, that God somehow designed the constellations such a way as to preach the gospel. The truth of the matter is, those constellations were configured and named to support a non-Christian creation myth. And then Christians have looked at that and said, well, maybe we can read the real story into it. But, you know, this is an exercise to demonstrate that this is really, you know, eisegesis putting into the stars the message you want to bring out. Just look up at those stars and say, does that really look like a woman sitting on a chair in terms of Cassiopeia? No, it looks like a big W to me. It's not even right side up. Yeah, the woman's falling out of the chair. You know, the only one that's even close is Orion. But in terms of Orion, the head looks kind of puny on top of these gigantic shoulders. But it's at least somewhat close. But almost every other constellation, I mean, does the Big Dipper really look like a bear? No, it looks like a Big Dipper to me. Goes back 4,000 years. So you can, you know, even earlier than that, about 4,500 years is when the constellations come into place. And one argument you can use that indeed there had to be a common creation experience in terms of what was communicated to the human species and a common flood experience, because of how remarkably similar all this stuff is. Well, I think there was some kind of common thread, because you see slight variations when you look at the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Egyptians. Even the Incas and the Aztecs had these constellation patterns that were remarkably similar to what you see in Mesopotamia. But I would argue that that is evidence that the human species was all residing in Mesopotamia. And then Genesis chapter 11, God scattered them over the face of the earth, and they took their stories and their creation myths and their astrology and their constellation, the zodiac. That's all over the planet. But the thing you notice is the farther you get from Mesopotamia in terms of geography and time, the more distorted the picture that you get. Yeah, the origin was pre-writing, but the very moment that writing shows up, Egypt and Mesopotamia, we see these constellations, the astrology, and the creation myth that comes out of the star patterns. So that's there from the very beginning of human writing. And they're all real close together. The constellation patterns are very similar from one culture to the next, which means they must have some common source. Yes. Right. Okay, how important were stars to the Jewish faith? Not as important as they were to the false religious systems that surrounded them. If you go back like 3,000, 3,500 years ago, the Egyptians were spending about 25% of their gross national product in supporting astronomy and astrology. 25%. Astronomers today would drool at I mean, these were the high priests of Egyptian society. They got whatever they wanted. Well, there was a price to pay. But the whole point is, like in Egypt, they wanted to make sure their pyramids were perfectly aligned on certain stars, and therefore they gave the astronomers everything they wanted. By the way, I don't think they were ever made to be eunuchs. However, there was a price to pay. If an astronomer failed to predict a solar eclipse, he lost his head. So, you were well supported. But if you're the wrong, then you paid with your life. So, yeah, no pressure. So, but no, it really is amazing how advanced their astronomy was. And that was saying a little bit earlier that, you know, you take people in a star party today and they're shocked that the stars actually move as the night goes by, and how the ancients always understood what was going on. That's because a lot more attention and money and education was focused on astronomy thousands of years ago compared to everything else. Well, there wasn't that many scientific disciplines taking people's attention back then as today. So, that's true. They could actually see the stars. So, in that sense, maybe we're going back on God's plan that these stars would serve as signs and seasons. Today, electronic watches would do the job. We never bother to look up at the stars. Can't see them anyway. But I think the point here in verse 33 is this whole point, do you know the laws of the heavens? And can you set up God's dominion over the earth? By the way, I've kind of underlined that in my Bible, and it does. As you go further into the creation accounts of the Bible, that theme is picked up again and again. And so this is the first time it makes this mention about the laws of heavens in terms of, you know, ruling a God system. And so what are these laws of heavens? And I would offer this particular translation in terms of what it says elsewhere in the Bible. The laws of heavens are the laws of physics. So I think it's not just referring to the spiritual component, it's actually focusing on the physical laws that govern the heavens and the earth. So God has set up laws. And in terms of how the Bible treats laws, unlike our laws, they're considered inviolable. You know, God has a system of laws, his moral law. He's got his spiritual laws, his physical laws. They're unchangeable laws. That's a theme you're going to see particularly as we get into the Psalms, how God's laws are perfect. God's laws are inviolable. They're unchangeable. They're fixed. And, this is a theme brought out in Jeremiah as well. But this is the first time it's actually addressed here. But it's kind of thrown out as a challenge to these five men. Look, you're talking about all the little stuff. Do you even know the basic laws under which this whole creation system operates? I mean, if you're trying to figure out what creation is all about, isn't that the first place you want to start? You know, what are the fundamental laws under which God has structured all this? And he's making a point. I know, but you don't know. Right. It really is amazing, because you're right. It wasn't until, about 400 years ago that people figured out, yeah, there really are laws out there that work consistently, that whereby we can structure everything and predict everything. And so if God's making a point, yeah, there really are laws out there, and you know what these laws are. Although as I kind of look at this discourse of these five men, I don't think they're disputing that point that there are laws. They just don't know what they are. So, but again, if you look at the context of this being one of the first books of the Bible ever written, some think it's the most ancient book in the Bible, certainly contemporaneous with the Moses books that Moses wrote, it's incredible. Do you know the laws of the heavens? Do we today know the laws of the heavens? Now, if you pick up a standard high school physics book, it makes the point, yeah, we know the laws. Here are all the laws. We teach all these laws to our kids. But do we really know the fundamental laws of physics? Do we have a unified field theory of physics today? We're still not there. So 3,500 years plus later, we're really no farther along in terms of everybody understanding the fundamental laws that govern and rule the heavens and the earth. Well, we are farther along, but in terms of really having a complete theory, we're not there. We won't be there for a while. Or, as some particle physicists pointed out, we're not going to get there until we get particle accelerators at least 40 trillion miles long. So in that sense, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I don't think we're any farther along making such a particle accelerator than the people in the days of Job were. So, creation day 5. That's covered in verses 16 to 18 and verse 36. So back to verse 18. It says, have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths of their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years. So this also overlaps creation day 1. Pardon me, I'm confused here. Verse 16 to 18. I was picking up creation day 1 again. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Now, putting this in a purely physical context, where is the place that we see the greatest evidence for physical death? It's the bottom of the ocean. That's where we see the greatest evidence for physical death in terms of the historical record. And it's interesting that this passage identifies as the depths of the sea as the places that are synonymous with the gates of death, the shadow of death. And the context here is most of the life on planet Earth resides in the ocean. And what happens to that life when it dies? It settles down to the bottom of the ocean. In terms of biodeposits that we mine, most of it is stuff that was once at the bottom of the ocean. So you get all this life that is living and dying, it settles on the bottom of the ocean. Plate tectonics comes along and subducts that stuff, and that's turned into continental land masses, and then we drill down and we mine that stuff. So, and yeah. That's true. All the dead life material and on the continental land masses gets washed down through rivers, settles on the continental shelves, again at the seafloor level. I think you might even get a reference here to sea vents. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? What are these springs of the sea? Well, now we understand that there are these things that we call deep sea vents, or walked in the recesses of the deep. And again, the point here is it's only been in the 20th century that we've discovered that there is even such a thing as deep sea life. Until the 20th century, the assumption was the sea life was all on the surface, and the deep sea was completely dead. Well, we now know that's not true. And in fact, life is quite prolific, particularly at these springs of the deep, these deep sea vents. It's completely different life, but life indeed is prolific at that point. But you know what Creation Day 5 is really talking about is where we see identifiable large creatures for the first time, literally the Cambrian explosion animals. You go back to Creation Day 1, the sequence opens up with where it says, let the oceans, let the seas produce these swarms of small sea creatures. So these are small sea animals in huge populations and great variety that God creates in the oceans. And indeed today we realize that is the Cambrian explosion. Where 543 million years ago, we have the sudden burst of these animals that have joints, appendages, internal organs. It's the first appearance of complex animal life. And they're not large. I mean, the largest goes up to about 40 inches. The biggest trilobites were about 40 inches across. So they really were swarms of small sea creatures. But it's the first time that you actually have what we would call complex life. Life that has arms and limbs and appendages and eyes and organs and internal organs. Before that, you had just unicellular life forms and colonies of unicellular life forms, the most advanced being sponges and jellyfish, which again are just organized colonies of these unicellular life forms. So then there's this sudden appearance of these creatures, and predominantly in the sea, and then it moves out from there. Okay, verse 36. Who endowed the heart with wisdom, or gave understanding to the mind? Now, what we see in Genesis chapter 1 is what takes place on creation days 5 and 6 at the end of creation day 5, not the beginning of creation day 5. This is when you see for the first time the soulish animals, the nephesh creatures. The word in the Hebrew is nephesh, and it's translated soulish animal. And by soulish animal, it means a creature, as it says here in verse 36, who has a heart with understanding, it's got a mind, it's got will and emotions. You won't find that defined in Genesis 1. This is the first indication of what really is being understood here by God creating these nephesh creatures. These are creatures that actually have a mind. They don't have a spirit, but they have a mind. They have the capacity to express emotion and receive emotion. And they also have a will. They can decide to do things and not decide to do things. Good examples of that are the pets that share your homes. And, you know, they're not as malleable as we'd like them to be. Especially the cats, okay? They seem to have a mind of their own. They decide what they want to do. But they obviously recognize the emotion that you give to them, and they can express the emotion back, and they actually have a mind. You can train them to do things. You know, I've heard of people trying to train grasshoppers to do things, but the truth is we just kind of set up the circumstances and makes it look like they're obeying our commands. So, but really they just do things, and their mind is not engaging our mind at all. But that is true of birds and mammals. Now, okay, bird, I'm going to, let me see, at 12:15. Let me just at least get through to this. We'll pick this up next time. But Creation Day 6 begins in verse 36. Same verse, who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Context of Creation Day 6. Creation Day 5, birds and mammals, great sea mammals and the birds. Creation Day 6 focuses on three specialized kinds of land mammals, the advanced land mammals that God especially creates to cohabit with human beings. And we're going to be able to get into this in some depth, particularly in chapter 39, because chapter 39 really does focus on the higher animals, the animals that God creates for human beings. So one thing you can say just in a gross generalization of chapter 39 is that the whole chapter is devoted to Creation Day 6. There's more going on in Job 39 than just Creation Day 6, but all the animals it talks about are Creation Day 6 mammals. Not all the mammals, but rather the mammals that God creates to cohabit with human beings. But one of the things we discussed when we got into Genesis 1 is exactly what kinds of land mammals is the text talking about in Genesis chapter 1. And it is a major source of dispute amongst Christians. This book I got out called A Matter of Days, while they're young earth creations, that strongly dispute the position I take on the interpretation of Creation Day 6. Likewise, atheists will criticize Creation Day 6 and say, hey, this is talking about all the land mammals, not just three specialized kinds of land mammals, and that is the case, we have proof that the Bible is filled with errors, because actually the land mammals show up before the sea mammals. Sea mammals are mentioned Creation Day 5, not Creation Day 6. You can get yourself in a lot of hot water on the interpretation of Creation Day 5 and Creation Day 6 if you fail to put it into context with Job 38 and then Job 39. So we'll do that next time. This will take a look at that. And by the way, this is a great place to go to say that carnivorous activity is not inherently evil. Again, that's an issue for both younger creations and atheists and agnostics. You know, if God's all-powerful and all-loving, especially all-loving, he's not going to create animals that eat other animals. Well, they need to look at what Job 38 and 39's got to say on that issue. Hopefully that gives you some motivation to come back next week. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we ask your blessing upon this mailing that will be going out to astronomers. We pray, Father, it would have a positive impact on helping them realize that not all Christians are against them. There are Christians that are for them. And Lord, I pray too that it would be a motivating gift to them, to encourage them to get involved in dealing with their students' questions and dialogues on this issue. Hopefully it'll open doors for them to actually see that the gospel is for them and not just for the non-astronomers that are out there. And Lord, I pray too that you would help these astronomers to take a positive approach in trying to bring healing on this issue both within the church and outside the church. So bless that effort, I pray, Father, and bless their time as we continue to go through this book of Job. Lord, help us to be open to particular messages that these chapters have for us living today. Lord, it's so easy to see this as something just applying to Job and his friends. But Lord, help us to pull out how you've written this, not just for them, but for us as well. So give us that sensitivity to see things in the text that may not otherwise be obvious. May it speak to us richly and deeply. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to use these texts to settle disputes and conflicts that both Christians and non-Christians have about your Genesis creation text. I pray you would give us those kinds of opportunities, even between now and next week. In Jesus' name, amen.